From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. By the time L. Frank Baum was in his early 40s, it seemed like he had tried everything. He'd been a chicken breeder, a salesman, an actor, a newspaper publisher. What he really wanted to be was a writer. But it's the typical story. He had a wife and kids and bills to pay, so he set the dream aside. Until one day in 1898, and an unusual sequence of images came to his mind, of a clever little girl and her brave little dog swept up by a terrifying twister and set down in a magical land. Today in the program, we're talking about Frank Baum and his wonderful Wizard of Oz. Evan Schwartz has written about Baum and his story. He'll join us today. He says Baum used the events of his own life to create a mythic pattern of symbols and events about a journey of self-discovery. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The film director Sam Raimi is just the latest to take on the story of The Wizard of Oz. His film Oz the Great and Powerful is a kind of prequel to the story most of us know. Evan Schwartz has studied Frank Baum and the tale that came to him one day of a Kansas prairie, a young girl, a dog, a twister, a magical land. There are witches in the story, of course, a scarecrow, a tin man, a yellow brick road. Schwartz says the elements of the story that Baum wrote out were mythic patterns and types that came from his own experiences, but also probably from his subconscious mind in some ways. So the story of the journey to Oz is a hero tale. It's about home. It's about self-discovery. Today in the program, Evan Schwartz is joining us to talk about L. Frank Baum's story, which he calls the country's most enduring tale of adventure. We invite you to join us with comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Evan Schwartz writes about technology and innovation. He was an editor at Business Week magazine, also a contributing writer for Wired. He now works with the consulting firm InnoSight. He's the author of the book Finding Oz, How L. Frank Baum Discovered the Great American Story. And he's joining us today from a studio in Boston. And Evan Schwartz, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. It's great to join you.
I wanted to start with this question that you ask in your book, because it seems like part of what interests you about the subject are the stories themselves. And the question that you ask, where do stories come from? You know, this idea of whether they're woven, as you put it, out of thin air, or are they inspired by our experiences and the people we meet? Start there, if you would. What is it that interests you about the idea of stories in terms of all of this?
Well, you know, the idea for the book came to me when I was reading Frank Baum's original Oz novel out loud to my daughter. She was 7 years old at the time, at bedtime, and when we got to the end and I read his bio and I saw he was 44 years old when he finally wrote the story and had failed at this long series of careers beforehand, I began to think, how does a great story happen? And that's really the question. You know, you could tap into all kinds of mythic archetypes if you know they exist, yeah. But you also have to have personal experience. And Frank Baum had a lot of failure, and he had some kind of talent for taking all his failures and the things he'd seen, from cyclones to yellow brick roads, and spinning it into this land. He created a land that is very three-dimensional and that we all know and love.
Joseph Campbell, the great scholar of myth, comes up a few times in your writing. And I'm wondering, it seems like in some ways you were thinking of Campbell and thinking of the idea of myth. How does he come into play in all of this? Because this idea of mythic structures is important, which I guess we'll get to as we go along.
Yeah, and when Frank Baum was writing The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which came to him rather suddenly in the year 1898, there wasn't much known about myth and mythology. Joseph Campbell came later. Freud's writings on what dreams are all about was actually happening at the very same time. So he didn't really know about this. But I think what he did know is that he grew up with stories like Alice in Wonderland. So he read Lewis Carroll, and he knew that myths inform us and guide us, and they have clues to our potential in life. And he knew this inherently, and he started writing children's books later in life, but he really embraced his true self when he did that, and it turns out the story of Dorothy is about a similar journey.
Yeah. You mentioned by the time the story comes to Frank Baum, he has tried all kinds of things. He was a chicken breeder and an actor and a salesman and a secretary for a baseball team, all these kinds of things. And for those days, by the time the story really comes to him, he's well past middle age. Was he looking for the right thing, or was he just trying to keep his head above water?
He was trying to support his family. He had four sons, and times were tough. There was a depression going on. He was living in Chicago at the time. But he also, in a way, overcame his fear. He failed at so many things, and the Cowardly Lion, I think, is really the embodiment of that journey, of convincing yourself that there are things to be afraid of. And there are all these elements in Oz that are like that, that these things are in our minds. They're perceptual, you know, good versus evil, dreams versus deluding yourself in terms of the wizard character. And being fearful is another thing. And he just somehow broke through that and embraced the fact that he wanted to write children's stories. And he was going to do it no matter what. And once he made that decision, the whole world opened up to him.
Let's talk about who he was. He seemed like a pretty gentle character, not exactly a tortured artist, it doesn't seem to me, but restless. He stayed at his parents' home until he was fairly old in the scheme of things. He worried about things like what people should call him. He kind of worked out different variations of his name. So he's worried about impressions. I guess it wouldn't be fair to say he was shallow, but I guess it would be fair to say he had his head in the clouds. Is that right?
Oh, he was definitely a dreamer. When he was a little kid, not a little kid, but early teens, his father sent him away to a military school. Yeah. And this was Frank Baum growing up as the son of a well-to-do man in the oil business. And the idea was to send your kid to a military school because it was a time of right after the Civil War. And essentially, he was miserable there. But when he got there in Peekskill, New York, he grew up in Syracuse, but he took a boat on the Hudson River and he got off the dock. And Peekskill was a Dutch city, and there were roads all around the town that were made of these Dutch paving bricks, and they were yellow. And this is just one example of a physical thing that he saw that later stuck in his mind. So if he asked anyone for directions to the school, they would have said, follow the yellow brick road, or they could have said that. And it was just one example of how a physical thing later became a metaphorical thing later in his life. And he managed to collect these things as he went along.
Are these things, this particular revelation of the yellow brick road, are these things that he talked about much, or is this stuff that you had to kind of, you know, piece together, uncover?
He talked about some of it, and some of it I had to piece together because he, as a novelist, as an author, didn't like to reveal his inner process. Yeah. He probably didn't quite understand it too. So there was a lot of research involved. So I went to Peekskill, New York, for instance, to the Historical Society, and it turns out there are maps that confirm these yellow brick roads were all over town, and a section of the road still exists. So you can go to Peekskill, New York, and see a section of the yellow brick road. And it's quite magical to find these things. And I went all over the country where he lived in various points of his life, looked up letters, interviewed some of his ancestors, and tried to piece it together and interpret some of the meanings of what happened in his life.
It must have been amazing to come across these iconic elements from the Yellow Brick Road, discovering that, for example. You must have been completely excited about discovering something like that and piecing these things together.
Oh, I did. I loved it. One of the other things that I found was, so he grew up in Syracuse, New York, upstate New York, and his father was in the oil business, and there was an offshoot business that the company founded that didn't sell oil for lighting or heating, but for lubrication.
Yeah.
So they made these cans of Bombs Castorine that were very much like the Tin Man's oil can. And it was just something that was incredible to find because the company, Bombs Castorine, which was founded in the 1880s, still exists. It's actually still a very successful product. It used to be a lubricant for buggy wheels. Now they use it for cars and all kinds of other things. But and I was able to interview the grandson of the grandson who bought the business from Frank Baum. So, and they had all kinds of archives there. And the Tin Man as a creation is just an icon that we all know. And he wouldn't be anywhere without that can of oil, right?
Mm. Let's talk about his wife, Maud. I want to work our way to how when Frank Baum discovers the story. But as you say, he discovers it somewhat later in his life. So I want to talk about different characters in his life that influenced this story. Maud, his wife, is an interesting character. Her mother, which we'll get to, is one of the most interesting things about her, I have to say. Suffice it to say that Maud is raised to be independent, and she sets aside her own career and her own aspirations really to follow her husband. Talk about Maud.
Yeah, well, there's a very strong feminist thread in The Wizard of Oz. And Frank Baum doesn't take it too seriously, but you could see he had four sons. So the fact that the main character is a girl is significant. And his wife, Maud, when he met her, she was a student at Cornell University, which was one of the first students in the country to have women going there, the first one on the East Coast. And essentially, she was very independent because she was the daughter of a real role model in the women's suffrage movement. And Frank's mother-in-law was a mother-in-law to be reckoned with. Her name was Matilda Jocelyn Gage. And she was one of the leaders of the women's suffrage movement, along with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And those three really founded the whole suffrage movement in America and wrote the books that formed the basis of the whole theory that women should have equal rights. But Matilda was the most uncompromising. She was very strident. People called her satanic and a heretic. And she really inspired a lot of the female characters, especially the good witch, the bad witch, and that whole duality. Because Frank saw this every day in his life, that his mother-in-law was being attacked. And people did not take this seriously. When his wife, Maud, was at Cornell, no one could vote, and it was considered laughable that that women would even suggest this idea.
Yeah. And it's fair to say Matilda was not crazy about the idea of Maud putting aside her college career there at Cornell. Didn't think much of Frank, at least not at the beginning, I guess.
No, Frank was a struggling actor at the time.
Yeah.
So he was living out this dream. He was touring the country with a musical production that he wrote. And Maud fell in love with him, but the mother-in-law was against this marriage. She said, "I will not let you be a darn fool and marry an actor." And that was the basis of their contentious relationship, at least at the beginning.
Yeah. Matilda Jocelyn Gage is interesting for all kinds of different reasons, radical, principled, as you say, and really taken by this study of theosophy. This spiritual view that kind of stripped out some conventional ideas in religion, like original sin and this idea of there being this, forbidden fruit, but also the dominance of one gender over another and the conflict that seemed to be – she seemed to kind of bristle against this idea that there's this conflict in religion between God and nature, God and humanity. Talk about her worldview. And do you think that influences Frank Baum eventually?
Oh, it definitely does. It's probably the biggest influence on him because she opened up a whole world of philosophy to him.
Yeah.
And she really was the one who inspired the philosophy and spiritual message of The Wizard of Oz. A lot of people listening might have heard that The Wizard of Oz is some kind of political parable about the politics of the 1890s when Frank Baum was writing it. And that's really not true at all. He wasn't really interested in politics. The story's really about this journey of discovering the true self. And his mother-in-law was a member of this thing called the Theosophical Society.
Yeah.
So it was an amalgam of Eastern religions like Buddhism and Hinduism, and that taught all is one and that good and evil, yin and yang, are part of the same thing, and that your dreams and being awake are very much tied together as the same whole. And those kind of ideas inspired things like the duality of Kansas and Oz, that they're not, as it turns out, separate places, but there's a lot of Kansas in Oz, and there's a lot of Oz in Kansas, and good and evil, and all these things that Buddhism and Hinduism might teach were very new in America, and they were marketed by this society called Theosophy, mm-hmm. and it was run by this woman named Madame Blavatsky, who was considered a charlatan. But Frank Baum, his wife, and his mother-in-law all joined the society, and they very much were reading about these spiritual messages and attending meetings. And it was very much a time of that kind of exploration of spirituality. And it became kind of a craze, and people like Thomas Edison even got swept up into it. He joined the Theosophy Society.
You write about how when he was younger, Frank Baum he bestows this name and this myth to the family property, which was known as Rose Lawn. He gives it the name Rose Kingdom. And you say in the book that Rose Lawn wasn't where Frank would experience the world, but rather where he took refuge from the world. And this idea of refuge, venturing out, all of that comes to be, again, an important theme. Talk about that part, if you would.
Yeah, another duality is home and away, that we dream of going somewhere, but there's no place like home. And that was really a message threaded throughout the original novel. He grew up in a very rich, fertile land that was more like the Land of Oz itself, that was unspoiled, full of flowers and trees and brooks, and Native American tribes were nearby. This was in upstate New York, a rural kind of kingdom because his father at the time was wealthy. And that helped inspire some of the images when he describes the rich foliage in the Land of Oz, but you know, he was also looking for a place of maximum contrast, and he had been to Kansas once and with his wife on the tour of his play as a young man, and they both proclaimed it the worst place they'd ever seen. It was gray and dusty, but really, he also lived not that far away in Dakota.
Right.
He left to sort of make his mark on the world, inspired by, you know, Mark Twain going west and finding himself as a writer. So he moved to Dakota, and that's where he saw tornadoes and droughts and a lot of this gray, parched land that was a lot like Kansas. And if you look at the way he describes Kansas, it's a lot like Dakota. At the Dakota Territory in the novel, and again, it's just the maximum contrast: black and white versus color.
I want to come back to that idea. You say early in the book that Frank Baum had a kind of faith that something wonderful was supposed to happen to him, and not only that, but as you put it in the book, something momentous stirred in America at large during this time of change. What are you getting at there?
It was. There was a lot of things to worry about and be fearful about back then. You know, when he was living in Dakota, there were droughts, and his business of running a store failed. His business of running a newspaper had failed. He was at the end of his rope. But then he heard about this magical exposition that would happen in Chicago, and it was called the Columbian Exposition of 1893. Some people know it as the White City. But he moved the family to Chicago to really be near that because it was the biggest event in American history at the time, and about a 1 in 4 Americans came to it. And if you look at the architecture from photos, it really inspired the Emerald City of Oz, and it's just a magical place. It was this sprawling event where all the countries of the world came to create pavilions for the World's Fair. And not only was Frank Baum there writing about it for the newspaper that he was working for at the time, but he was caught up in a lot of the things going on there. And so was the illustrator for the original Oz novel, William Denslow, was illustrating the World's Fair for the Chicago papers at the time. So you could see a lot of the architecture, the cupolas, the all the spires that you see in the Emerald City in the original novel, also in the film. But they were really inspired by this magical place. And Frank Baum and many Americans had never seen anything like it.
I want to ask you, there's an email from the NPR correspondent Howard Berkus, who's listening in. And he said, while working on some stories more than a decade ago about the reconciliation effort in South Dakota between whites and Native Americans, he said, we came across some of Baum's writings. Howard writes, he was a notorious Indian hater and called for the extermination of Native Americans. Howard wants to know how those views are manifested in his writings about this, you know, magical land of Oz.
Yeah, this is a controversial and painful subject, and I could have ignored it, but I really wanted to tackle it head on because I think it was a really big part of his life. When he moved out to Dakota, there were wars with the Indians that were culminating, and Chief Sitting Bull was there, and they were doing this thing called the Ghost Dance, and they were starving, and everyone thought that the Indians were gonna attack the city of Aberdeen where Frank Baum lived. And it was a really dark time. And Frank Baum wasn't the only one. It was conventional wisdom that the whites of America were afraid of the Indians, that they were wiping them out. This had been going on for the entire 19th century. So it's not like Frank Baum was the only one, but he wanted to please his readers, and he wrote some really horrible genocidal things at the very height of the Indian scare, right before the Wounded Knee Massacre in 1891. So it was a really dark time, and it set up a real uncomfortable situation with his mother-in-law, who was very much embraced Native Americans and was inspired by the philosophy of Native Americans. And soon after that, Frank really changed and had an awakening. He never did anything like that again, but it was the lowest point of his life. And his ancestors, the story you're referring to about 10 years later, his ancestors went out to the Dakota reservations and apologized to the ancestors of Wounded Knee, and there was a little reconciliation at that point.
So do we see anything like that in any of these patterns or characters or structures or, you know, the land itself when he was writing Oz? Did that come up? I mean, that was the essence of Howard's question. Was any of that reflected in the story?
I think it was. There are, you know, sometimes when authors are coming up with metaphors and imagery, sometimes they'll come out of thin air and sometimes they're meaningful. But I look at the poppy field and the field of poppies. Some people think it's reflective of opium because they fall asleep in the poppy field. But there's also in Europe, a poppy day is considered a commemoration of World War I, and that's because poppies are red and they connote a battlefield, a field of blood. And I call this chapter in the book The Field of Blood because it's a narcotic of racism that people get trapped in, and it could really destroy you and do you in. You know, the characters in the book get they're almost done in if they're not saved by other forces. Mm-hmm. In the movie, it's Glinda who saves them with Snow,
and
they wake up. But I think that's reflective of Frank Baum's experience, and that's my interpretation. But I think something so dramatic and really the most traumatic time in his life had to have affected him in some way.
Evan Schwartz is with us. His book is Finding Oz, How L. Frank Baum Discovered the Great American Story. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, not the movie with Judy Garland, we're not talking about the new one with James Franco, but we're talking about the story itself, conjured up by L. Frank Baum. Baum is an interesting character. For years, he had tried to get something to work in his life. But then when he's around 40 years old, his early 40s, this story comes to him of a clever little girl and her brave dog swept up by this terrifying twister. The journalist Evan Schwartz is our guest today. He's written about Baum and this story. And you can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. The book is called Finding Oz, How L. Frank Baum Discovered the Great American Story. So you talk about how, in some ways, all of these threads now that you've been piecing together about his life, something happens on a day in 1898 when they all seem to align in some ways. I'm not sure if that's quite how we should put it, but he does say that the story seemed to write itself. What do we know about that day, and what do we know about how it came to him, the story?
Well, what we know about that day in 1898 is that he had already started writing children's books.
Yeah.
And they were moderately successful. He wrote something called Mother Goose in Prose, and which was a twist on the old Mother Goose tales. And he really liked this. And he was out playing with his sons one day, and it was dusk, and he was coming back home. And there was something that struck him, and he described it like he was a radio receiving something. And he went into the vestibule of his house in Chicago, and it all came to him. He said later that he started writing things down on scraps of paper, the backs of envelopes, and it was Dorothy. It was a twister. It was a girl with the dog going to this mystical, magical land, witches, and a quest to find a wizard. It all seemed to come to him in a moment, and he just was just racing to write down as much of it as he can. And he talked about that moment later on. So it was, to me, it was just a magical thing of how does creativity happen? You know, he took, you know, a good part of a year to write and perfect the story, yeah, to collaborate with an illustrator, to find a publisher. And so there were all kinds of things that were part of that process, but I don't think any of it would have happened if it wasn't for this magical moment that he had. And you see his whole life just changed with that day.
But he was pretty coy about really where it came from. I mean, you talk about how he's trying to explain to people where the idea of Oz comes from. And because mm-hmm. a little girl, I guess, where this is the story made up anyway, maybe true, I'm not really sure. But she says, she wants to know how you got the name of this magical place. And he tells her that he gets it from the letters of a filing cabinet as he's looking
That's
around
right.
the room bottom, or something
the bottom
like that.
Drawer.
Yeah.
And, you know, the top drawer had A to F and the bottom drawer had O to Z.
Right.
So he says it's just a thing that he saw in his office. And it may or not may not be true. I don't think it is. And we don't know exactly where the word Oz came from, only that he made it up, just like he made up a lot of other things like Munchkins. Mm-hmm. We know a little bit about where the word Munchkin comes from. It's his ancestors came from Germany. His father, his brother would go back to Germany a lot. And there's a mascot for the town of Munich, the city of Munich, that's actually still the mascot of Oktoberfest to this day. And it's called the Münchner Kindl, the Munchkin, the Munich child. And so it wasn't Dunkin' Donuts. It was Frank Baum who came up with that. And where the word Oz came from is not that important. It certainly is memorable and mellifluous. But the main thing is that he created this three-dimensional land that had all these characters in it. And how is one person able to create 20 or 30 icons that over 100 years later, everyone on the planet knows about?
Mm. You describe it in the book as a story that seems to fit into a spot in one's consciousness. Talk about what you mean by that, he found the wheelhouse in terms of not just his, but other people's consciousness, I guess.
I think everyone goes through this, and it could be when you're a little kid. Here I am at home, but what if I went away? Mm-hmm. Who am I? And, you know, I don't really like it here. I'm not happy. There's a land over the rainbow. Or it could happen later like it did with Frank Baum. You know, am I a should I be running a variety store? Should I be a newspaper writer? Who am I? For him, it was in midlife. And everyone's always on this quest to find themselves. And the Yellow Brick Road is this metaphorical quest. So there's something about that metaphor that just fits into your mind. And it was an immediately successful book. Mm-hmm. It was so simple that kids could understand it, yet as we're talking, we see it's actually a very complex story. So, and that's what great myths do. They take something as complex as who you are and your place in the world and make it so fun and familiar.
Talk about the idea of witches, where this comes from for Frank Baum. In her public speeches, his mother-in-law, this really powerful figure you were talking about, she often spoke about the time when the witches were burned. And you say that she kind of drew this link between the accusations of witchery and the teachings of religion. This is something she was attacking, organized religion and how it treated women. Talk about the idea of witches. Is this part of where this comes from, you think?
Well, of course, witches have been part of mythology for hundreds of years before Frank Baum. But what he was really getting at and what he was really influenced by was, this was fascinating. His mother-in-law was the foremost expert on medieval witch hunting. Mm-hmm. And the people who were burned at the stake for being heretics. And they were, and as Matilda would say, they were often the wisest women of the community. They were sometimes old. Sometimes they had money that the church wanted to take. Sometimes they were experimenting with strange medicinal herbs that were considered heretical. And essentially, they were scapegoats in the Dark Ages. And it was just an interesting duality that a witch could be considered evil by someone but considered good by someone else. And this is what he explored in his novel. And the idea of a good witch was really something Frank Baum pioneered.
Yeah.
There were fairies, but the idea of a good witch, and Glinda serves as the mentor figure, right, for Dorothy in the book. So it's really it's really important that really this fear, this evil we ascribe to witches, is something that's perceptual, and as you mentioned it earlier, his mother-in-law analyzed a lot of where this came from, and part of it she traced back to some of the myths in the Bible, like the Garden of Eden, where Eve bit the apple, and that was sort of they were cast, she was cast out of Eden at that point. And it was really interesting to see the new movie Oz, Great and Powerful, how witches were treated in that story. And part of it, they say that the writers of that movie, the new movie, give L. Frank Baum credit for inspiring it, and the Oz character, Oscar Diggs is his name, the James Franco character, that comes from Baum's novels, the sequels especially. He wrote 14 Oz novels.
Right.
So there's a lot of material that's left unexplored, and the movie looks fantastic. But someone who's really been steeped in Frank Baum's life, I think I was disappointed with the way they portrayed women and the witches in the movie. They even had sort of that cliche of the Mila Kunis character is given the apple by her wicked sister, and she becomes evil. And so they were using that old myth, and sort of I think that's really a pretty lazy way of making someone evil. And they even go on a witch hunt in the movie with sort of no irony that this is, of course we have to find the evil witch. And the way the women in that movie, the three witches, were manipulating each other and defined by their relationship with James Franco was really antithetical to how Matilda Gage would have looked at the world, or how Frank Baum would look at the world. So that part of it was disappointing, even though they did have some clever plot twists.
Yeah, but it makes you wonder whether or not they got it at all. I mean, there's a deeper story in here, and you don't have to understand all of the tropes, of myth, but this idea of home, this idea of women, those kinds of things. If you read Baum's story, I mean, there is a deeper story going on. At least that's what you write about, anyway.
There is a deeper story, and the original book, and especially the 1939 movie, has heart and magic, and it's, and the heart is about Dorothy's journey, and you don't get that in the new movie. The main character is the wizard, but you don't know what motivates him except for not being a con man. His journey is not set up very well, even though the opening sequence looks fantastic, the black and white sequence before he goes to Oz. But it's not set up well, and you don't sort of feel that – you don't identify with him or feel that heart that you do in the original movie. It might not be a fair comparison to compare any movie to, one of the greatest films of all time. But they are trading in the same myth, so I think it is indeed fair to compare them.
Evan Schwartz is with us. His book is called Finding Oz, How L. Frank Baum Discovered the Great American Story. And you can join us, 801-585-WEST. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Evan Schwartz. We're talking about his book, Finding Oz, How L. Frank Baum Discovered the Great American Story. Here's an email that comes to us via Twitter from Jeremy, who writes, in the pantheon of classic epic fiction, Oz appears to be a standout American one. Jeremy wants to know, is there something uniquely American about Oz?
That's a great question, because I think there is. And we were talking about the wizard character. who is the most complex character. He's the only one who's who lies, mm-hmm. and he changes form. And we were talking about how he's portrayed in the new movie as compared to the other movie. And there's something very American about him. And Frank Baum was obsessed with some of the great famous heroes of his age. And one of them, of course, was Thomas Edison, who was the Wizard of Menlo Park. And there's a lot of Edison in the Oz character. Frank Baum, when he was in Chicago, right before the World's Fair started, was a reporter and attended a Thomas Edison press conference. So he actually encountered Edison in person and wrote a whole article about him. And it was just a fascinating thing that I found in the Chicago Historical Society, this article, Frank Baum. He talked about Edison's massive head, and he talked about the wizard introducing his greatest invention of all time. He was just hinting at it. But what Thomas Edison was going to do is he already had invented the electric light and the phonograph, and he was going to introduce motion pictures at the World's Fair. And Frank Baum was at this press conference and really was taken by him in a very lyrical way. But another great American mythological figure, probably even more famous than Edison worldwide, was P.T. Barnum.
Yeah.
Frank Baum made a very lifelong study of P.T. Barnum about the man who would deceive people, the phrase, a sucker is born every minute, the person who came up with these fake illusions and created museums and circus sideshows. And there's a lot of P.T. Barnum in the wizard character, the man behind the curtain. And this is a very, very American thing. When I was writing the book was when Americans had been taken in by another scandal, another con, and that was, the mortgage bubble.
Yeah.
And before that, it was the internet bubble. And Frank Baum wrote about this when he wrote about P.T. Barnum, that we live in an age of deception. And if Americans see something that's too good to be true, we want in on it.
Yeah.
And that's a very American thing, to really be gullible and yet taken in by magic at the same time. So it was no coincidence that the three-ring circus and all these magical things and inventions were happening in America. And Frank Baum took all that and built it right into his story.
It's interesting how many different people find their own kind of interpretations in the story. They draw their own kind of motivation from it. The great writer Salman Rushdie is written about being profoundly influenced by Frank Baum and his books. And he sees it he sees the idea of exile as one of the most important concepts in the book. What do you make of that?
Well, I think The Wizard of Oz is a parable of the American dream.
Yeah.
Because it's Dorothy who wants to be all she can be, and this is what the American dream is about. It's not just owning a house and a car, but being the best person you could possibly be and achieve. And people That's appealing to people all over the world. And I think when I was reading about what Salman Rushdie wrote, he grew up in India and was reading the novel or saw the movie and decided to become a writer.
Yeah.
Because of his Oz experience, and dreamed of going to America and a land somewhere else. And so it turns out it's very universal,
mm-hmm.
and that it's affected people all over the world.
Near the end of Baum's story, you write about how Dorothy realizes essentially what Toto had kind of sensed all along, that the wizard isn't really trustworthy, doesn't really know what he's doing. So she's going to have to complete this journey herself. And the book ends differently than the MGM movie. She doesn't just wake up. And in fact, she isn't asleep. She wasn't asleep. These adventures weren't a dream. Talk about why you think that's important.
It's important because it's a concept that comes from theosophy and this philosophical belief system that Frank Baum had. And what they call it in theosophy is astral travel. I don't know if you've heard of traveling to the astral plane. This was sort of big in 60s drug culture.
Yeah.
But it was really something that was talked about back in the 1890s, that you could project yourself through meditation to a different plane, to a different level of experience, and have some kind of journey. They call it samadhi in Hinduism, but a lot of these Eastern religions, they all have their names for it. And in the book, Dorothy goes to the Land of Oz, and when she comes back, the house that she traveled in is no longer there. So in the movie, she wakes up in bed and it was all a dream.
Right.
In the book, it was a real journey. Yeah. And when the house went to the Land of Oz, it didn't come back. Auntie M had to essentially build the house again. So there's a new house in its place. And Toto is the only one who goes to both places. Toto is her spiritual guide and a very important part of the story. And Frank Baum invented Toto as well.
Yeah.
And Toto goes to the Land of Oz and in Kansas. But the movie sort of conveniently says, oh, Dorothy wakes up in bed and was all a dream. And in the book, that's one of the biggest differences. It was an actual experience. Or it's really part of that yin and yang, that what's real and what are imagined are part of the same thing, and you really can't distinguish it.
Yeah. So she brings together these two worlds. And you say it's kind of like the Buddha concept, that Dorothy has kind of attained enlightenment. There's this transformation of her consciousness.
Yeah. And in the book, if you read the last two or three pages, when she wakes up in Kansas, she's sitting on the grass, sort of meditative style, cross-legged, and that's where she wakes up in this state of this yogic state. So it really is, and she does master the two worlds. That's really one of the takeaways, that she's happy with who she is now. There's no place like home, like Kansas. She's okay with it because she can dream and go somewhere else whenever she wants and be all she can be. She's realized something about herself that's very strong.
You say there's another hero in this story. You say the other hero is L. Frank Baum himself, who discovered a story that would get to this eternal truth, what you call the divinity within oneself. Because you say Baum introduced this idea of human divinity into American consciousness.
I wouldn't say he introduced that idea. I would say he popularized it through the story.
Yeah.
But some of the theosophists and some people, even like Emerson, who believed in this human divinity, that we could have part of God inside of ourselves. Even Jesus said that. So it's not a totally new idea, but it's a very profound one, and especially to get into a children's story. And the story is just so much fun and entertaining that it doesn't feel like it's giving you some kind of spiritual message. But I think that's what really resonates with people.
So how did Oz, this experience writing this book, these books, how did it change Frank Baum? I mean, it made him successful for sure. It helped him achieve, as you talk about in the book, you know, a sense of harmony and happiness. But you also say it didn't really change him that much. I mean, he still had this tendency to overdo things. So what difference did it make, do you think, to Frank Baum, this story that he had found?
Yeah, it's funny because he embraced who he was and he became very successful. It's really like the J.K. Rowling of his time.
Yeah.
But he didn't change in that he was still a lousy businessman. He invested in ways to exploit the story, like stage plays and radio shows. And he even created a film studio. He went to Hollywood and created silent movies about Oz. He lost all his money several times over. But he kept earning it back by writing sequels to the original Oz novel. And he didn't change in one sense, in that he was still a dreamer and still was struggling to figure out what he was going to do next. But it didn't matter anymore because he had introduced something that changed the world, that changed him. And he was truly happy the rest of his life.
So what do you think The Wizard of Oz fits now in terms of American stories? I mean, I guess you feel a little conflicted. You've got this movie out, and so people are thinking, like us, are thinking about Frank Baum and the story in general. I guess it goes back to this idea of you saying it's really, in some ways, it's a universal story. So I guess you feel pretty hopeful that it's going to endure.
Oh, it's amazing how it's endured so far, and it's really only getting stronger because we all grew up with it. It's the movies, the 1939 movie is the most seen movie of all time, and it's also the one where we watch again and again, especially as kids.
Yeah.
And we all can, you know, our culture is so fragmented now. We have thousands of channels and a million websites and so many things to pay attention to. And no one watches the same thing anymore like they did when there were only three TV channels. But if someone on a TV show or in another movie refers to I don't think we're in Kansas anymore or I'll get you, my pretty, everyone knows these lines. Everyone knows the Yellow Brick Road. Everyone knows the Ruby Slippers. It's what unifies us. And, you know, people can't agree on much, but I think most people still love The Wizard of Oz.
Evan Schwartz, the author of the book Finding Oz, How L. Frank Baum Discovered the Great American Story, joined us today from a studio in Boston. Evan Schwartz, thanks very much.
Oh, thanks, Doug. It was a pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to our intern, Taylor Almond. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.